Well, this is the hour. We'll take your phone calls with Seth Shostak from the SETI Institute, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. A few more questions, and we'll dive into the calls. Welcome back. George Norrie with you, along with Seth Shostak from the SETI Institute. Seth, what would you say is the most outrageous thing you've ever heard about the search for extraterrestrial life?
Well, I don't know. I haven't heard a whole lot that's been outrageous. Some of it's been pretty heated, but not totally outrageous. I mean, some people would say, look, you know, I guess the most outrageous thing, I just recant what I just said. I think it's going to be the people who tell me all the time, well, you guys would never tell us. You're well aware that there are, you know, signals from aliens, and you just don't want to tell us.
See, and I defend you on that, by the way. Publicly, I defend you on that.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, no, yeah. And I don't hear that very often, but when I do, I just, you know, I would say I scratch my head, but I don't even do that.
Question about Arecibo. What's the James Bond movie that it was highlighted in?
Yeah, I think it was GoldenEye.
That's it. You're right. 1995.
Yeah, I think that there was actually a second film that involved Arecibo as well, but... I think in GoldenEye, the idea was that they were going to use Arecibo to destroy London.
Jeez.
I don't
know. Grab the signal off it or something.
Yeah, it wasn't clear to me how it was going to destroy London. Maybe it would take out part of London if you dropped it on it.
When you see it up front and personal, it's pretty awesome, isn't it?
Well, it was. It was indeed. I was, you know, there was a lot of sentimental feeling when that telescope collapsed. And also surprised, because... I think anybody who has visited and looked at the cables that held that all together, you know, you would think they're never going to give way, and yet they did.
Did it collapse because of some prior earthquake that may have weakened it?
Well, nobody apparently knows, or at least at the time that I was paying attention to this, nobody knew why it collapsed. Maybe not earthquakes, although they do have them, but maybe the hurricanes somehow weakened it. The engineers who built that built it pretty darn well, but there was something they missed, and I don't know what it was.
When you tell people what you do, are you an astronomer first, or are you a SETI person first?
Well, it depends on if
where you are, huh?
Well, it depends. Yeah, if you're sitting on a long flight, I probably would say astronomy. If I say SETI, we're going to have a long conversation.
Well, I don't know how many people would try to get away from you. I mean, I think a lot of people would be fascinated by that.
Well, I like to think so, George, but, you know, as I think Clint Eastwood said in a film once, a man's got to know his limitations.
Yeah, exactly. Or he said something else about you, punk.
Yeah.
Whatever that was.
He said a lot of memorable stuff.
Let's take some calls for you. Let's go to Brendan in Austin, Texas to get us started. Hey, Brendan.
Hey, George and Seth, thank you guys so much, and all the Coast to Coast listeners.
Thank you, and thank you for being a great caller, by the way, Brendan. You're on target all the time.
Thank you. I'll try to keep up that expectation. I try to make it interesting, you know. That's what Art Bell always used to say, when you call in, make it interesting, you know.
Yep.
That's what I was about to say, is that I listen to Art Bell, and I've heard Seth on there before, and one of the times he came on, you were talking about the inverse square law and how that affects everything coming into Earth and everything coming out of Earth, and pretty much everything with SETI revolves around that scientific law. And it's kind of I'm not a scientist, so I have a hard time understanding some of these things, and I just wanted to hear you elaborate on how the inverse square law affects the energy and signals going into space. And also, it kind of seems like a Schrodinger's energy type thing. And that, I mean, that it's safe and not safe at the same time. Because inverse square law is what keeps us safe from 5G and microwaves and radio. But also, we can use it to sterilize medical equipment and even with weapons with Raytheon. So how does that affect safety, the inverse square law of the energy? Thank you.
Yeah, well, Brendan, the inverse square law is just really, it's just geometry more than anything. You know that if you have a flashlight, right, and, you know, somebody holds it 2 inches from your head, it's going to be really hard on your eyes, very bright. But if they move with that flashlight to the other end of the room and shine it at you, it's not quite so bad. And if they're, you know, half a mile away, you know, it's almost nothing. Now, that's just saying that the intensity of the light, that is, if you will, the amount of light per square foot or whatever, you know, is diminishing as you get farther away from it. And that follows what's called the inverse square law. If you measure the intensity of a flashlight beam at 10 feet, and it's, you know, some value, at 20 feet it'll be 1/4 that value because you've increased the distance by 2. So 2 squared is 4, and that's the inverse square law. It applies to essentially everything, not just radio waves and light waves, but almost, you know, everything that you can aim at anybody. I mean, it protects you from, if you're worried about 5G, and I don't know whether I should be worried about it, but if you are worried about it, you know, if you were within 1 foot of the you know, transmitters on that tower there, you're going to get a lot of microwave radiation. But if you get away 1,000 feet or 2,000 feet or 10,000 feet, it gets weaker.
Last night I was talking about parallel universes and time travel with an engineer, a fascinating discussion, Seth. And he was talking about all these possible parallel universes. As an astronomer, what do you think of that?
Well, it's certainly an interesting, even a compelling idea that, you know, there isn't just one universe. And it's sort of, I don't know, philosophically kind of satisfying too, because, you know, we used to think that the solar system was the only solar system. We used to think the Earth was the center of everything, actually. And we've always found out that, well, you know, no, that isn't true. There are actually lots of other planets, and, oh, there are lots of other stars, and there are lots of other galaxies. So in a sense, you might say from the get-go, the idea that there might be lots of other universes isn't so crazy sounding. But the reason that people are investigating it, and, you know, it certainly hasn't been proven, but the reason they investigate it is otherwise you have to somehow explain why this, the only universe, was set up in such a way that, you know, it would produce stars and planets and life. I mean, why are we here? If you change some of the physical constants of our universe, even slightly, it makes a big difference. And, you know, maybe you don't get stars and you don't get planets. So the solution to that problem, and the problem is, you know, why is it that we're so special, is that if you have a gazillion other universes, well, most of them aren't very good, but a couple of them are. Sort of like lottery tickets. Most of them aren't any good, but a few are. And that's the reason why parallel universes sound like a good idea.
Of course, you just need one good lottery ticket. That's
yes.
It.
Yes.
You don't need them all. Joe in the Bronx. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Hey, George. How are you?
All righty. Thank you.
Good, good. Seth, I want to know, now, what is the likelihood, the most likelihood, that platinum record that was launched into space, seems like eons ago now, would be discovered by ET? And also, what is the most likely frequency that you know of that ET would be transmitting on?
Yeah, well, the second one is simple to answer, Joe, because, you know, people thought about that right from the get-go, from 1960. There is one frequency that everybody who can build a radio receiver will know, and that's 1420 megahertz on your radio dial. That's because hydrogen, which fills the universe, right, emits naturally a signal, some static, if you will, at that frequency. So we know about that, but any aliens that do astronomy will also know about it. So maybe that's the best frequency. That's been thought to be the case for more than 50 years. And your other question was, what are the chances that anything we send into space will be picked up by aliens? Yeah, that was kind of, you know, the story of...
Well, that was in 1977 on the Voyager.
Right. The Voyager and the Pioneer both carried messages, if you will. I mean, they were like greeting cards.
We're over here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, that's right. They were also maps of where we are, which you could say maybe isn't a good idea. It depends on how you feel about it. But those things are moving out into space at the rate of about, you know, somewhere between 7 and 10 miles a second. Okay. And that's pretty fast, at least if you're just going to New York or something like that. But at that rate, it would take them about 100,000 years to reach the nearest of the other stars. And, you know, these are about the size of a VW Beetle, Joe. So, you know, if they pass within 10 million miles of somebody else's planet, how is anybody going to see it? I mean, it's hard to believe that anybody would see it.
Seth, let me ask you this, too. You're an astronomer. You have looked at celestial objects through amazing telescopes. You have seen the awe of the universe. Are you spiritual?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure that I know anymore what spiritual means. I'm not, you know, terribly religious, I have to say that. But it is, I mean, I don't think, well, I don't think most people can walk out.
And you know where I'm headed with this.
Well, I think so. Maybe I'll just say, let's go directly there because, you know, I'll save you all this boring.
Intelligent design.
Yeah, intelligent design. No, I don't think so. There's too much evidence for evolution. And evolution...
But evolution can be intelligent design, too.
Well, but the fact that things just change sort of randomly, and then there's this big filter called survival. And if, you know, you survive, then, you know, you're good for the next generation. And that clearly has produced all the species on Earth. Now, maybe what you're really asking is, well, how did the first life get started? We have some ideas about that. But maybe the question is, well, look, is there really, you know, some sort of superintelligence, God, if you will, behind all this? And that's a question that science really can't answer.
You know, I've seen our little babies grow up. But I know one thing for sure. When a little baby is born, it can't take care of itself.
Right.
At all. How in God's name,
so to speak,
beep, did a first human get created as a baby? Now, you know, the Bible talks about Adam and Eve. They were full-grown adults. But let's negate that for a moment. Assuming evolution occurred, it's not a full-grown human.
No.
So it had to have been a baby. How did it survive?
Well, a lot of them didn't to begin with. But look, it isn't that humans were the first critters to require that their young get a lot of attention at the beginning, right? You know, watch these nature shows, you know, Richard Attenborough and so forth, and you see, you know, a wildebeest being born on the savannah, and within an hour, it's standing up and running around.
Right, right.
Okay, but it has to do that, because if it couldn't do that, it's probably get, you know, it would just be lunch for a lion.
But it had a mother wildebeest to take care of it.
It did, but the mother, it did, but she didn't have to take care of it for 18 years or anything like that. And we do have that. To begin with, we have the human babies have a lot of defects. They have these big heads, you know, because they got big brains. You know, there's always trouble with the.
Yeah, but here's the question: how did the baby survive when there was no apparent adult around to take care of it?
Well,
the first ones now.
Well, the first one didn't, you know, just sort of pop out of the ether. The first one had a mother, right? And you go back and you look at the
well, where did that mother come from?
Well, it's just a continuous, you know, you have to just go back in time. Look, our predecessors were apes, okay? I know there are people who don't like that idea, but it seems to be the case. And if you look at apes and they have a baby, they take care of the babies. The babies are hanging on to them and so forth, and they take care of them for years.
Right, I agree. But okay. So let's go back to the very first ape.
Yeah,
that was
you go
born.
Back to first ape, and then you have one.
You had to have two of them, right? A male and female ape to get started.
Oh yeah.
And how did that happen?
Well, because whatever produced the apes, whatever critter was, you know, the predecessor of the apes, they also had that, and it goes back to a point where life is so different that, you know, you didn't need parenting. Well, you know, bears, the males don't hang around in most cases, right? That's true for quite a number of mammals, and you know, fish, they spawn and so forth, and then they leave. They either die or they take off. They don't stay around and try and help their progeny, their kids. They don't do that. But at some level of complexity, it turns out that they do start doing that, and there's a big advantage, because if you can give birth to something that, yeah, it's pretty helpless, but if you keep parenting it, then it learns a lot of stuff. It's able to be taught something, and it doesn't rely entirely on instinct, because you can teach it stuff.
It is bizarre, though, isn't it?
Well,
if
yeah.
We went back into time to see the very first human being born, there's nobody there to take care of it.
Well, it's what happened to its mother? Did she fly the coop?
Well, that's my point. How did that mother come?
Oh, you're saying, all right, the first human, you know, well. Well,
there had to be a first human somehow.
Well,
how did it appear?
Well, I think you would have a hard time pointing to the first human, because, you know, if you just looked at all the generations, and there've been hundreds of thousands of generations of apes in humans, right, if you count the apes, you know, there's sort of a progression. They slowly got to be a little different than their predecessors.
Right.
They started walking upright. They started, you know, and when the females were walking upright, suddenly the birth canal was shorter and it was tougher to give birth. And, you know, but all these things happen mostly gradually. It isn't that overnight, oh, no more apes, and now we have humans, right? There was something in between.
Let's go to Roger, Amherst, Massachusetts, first-time caller. Hi, Rog, go ahead.
Hi. Mr. Shostak, I disagree with some of the things that you said. You said, like, for instance, why would we care or if there are other species out in space, other life forms? And the thing is, it's not a matter of just caring or knowing. It's a matter of human evolution. I mean, and you were saying that the human, we're going to disappear at some time. The human race has been developing for hundreds of millions of years, and we're going to be around for hundreds of millions of years. We're going smarter, more and more powerful all the time. And our next step is to join the interstellar family that you don't seem to care about, because we're going to be eventually exchanging our genes with them.
Well, he cares about them, Rog. He just doesn't believe they've come here. Seth, I'll let you answer that.
Okay. Well, Roger, listen, I appreciate your optimism that we're going to be around for hundreds of millions of years, but it's certainly not the case that we have been around for hundreds of millions of years, right? If you go back 100 million years to begin with, most of the big things on Earth are dinosaurs, right? There are no humans walking around, none, and there aren't any big apes either, 100 million, just 100 million years. Homo sapiens, when did that begin? It isn't that, you know, overnight it began, but when we got to the point where you could say, okay, this looks more like a human, right, the skulls or whatever bones you find, that's on the order of about 300,000 years, okay? So you go back and now you're looking at something that's a lot hairier than we are. It looks like, you know, what you see in the museums, okay? But the idea that we're guaranteed to go forward a couple hundred million years, yeah, I'd love that idea, but I don't think there's any guarantee that that will happen.
Joe, Long Island, New York, welcome to the program. Go ahead, Joseph.
Yeah, hi, Seth. My question would be, and then I have a comment. My question's about the directional flow within the solar system or in terms of what you're seeing, what you're hearing, whether it's outward from the sun, going, you know, outward from the solar system towards us, circular around the solar system. And the same thing for is stuff coming in from interstellar space from different directions, not just Alpha Centauri, you know, based on our position in the Milky Way. And my comment on what you were just saying is, I wonder if we could teach apes to speak English to any degree and get their thoughts on evolution and these various topics.
Well, if they knew, but I'm not sure they do. Seth?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think you could get you could teach apes to speak. I think that they don't have the anatomy for that, to speak English, right? They obviously communicate, but speaking English, you have all of those things in your throat, right? That's sort of a system that allows you to make all the sounds required for a complex language, right? And also, you've got the brain that allows you to do that. Now, the apes may have sort of the brain, probably not enough to do very good English, but okay. Maybe the problem there isn't the brain so much as the anatomy of their vocal tract, if you will. I'm not an anatomist, so I can't say exactly what's wrong there. But
not a bad answer, Seth. We're going to come back and take final calls with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be back in a moment with final calls with Seth Shostak from SETI, so get ready. Next hour, Coriel Kramer joins us. She's an animal communicator. If you're into animals, you're going to love the next 2 hours, so stick with us on Coast to Coast. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Seth Shostak. Seth, how many years you've been doing this now with us and Art prior to me, even 18 years going on with me?
Yeah, is that true? Gosh.
I know, it's amazing.
That's depressing. Well, yeah, I don't remember. What I do remember is sitting at my desk here in Mountain View, California, a long time ago, and I got a phone call from Art Bell, and he said he wanted me on his show. But I'm not exactly sure when that was. It was in the 1990s. That much I do know.
probably around 95, 96, something like that. Yeah. And then I think I had heard you on Art's show and called you on my St. Louis Nighthawk show.
Right.
And then I got you on, and then we've all stayed friends and everything else. We've been at conferences together. Yep. I remember the great debate you had with the late Stanton Friedman. That was fun, too.
I do, and I actually lament quite a bit that Stanton passed away.
I miss that guy.
Yep.
I really do. And you want to hear about strange synchronicities. He was my very first radio interview when I was 21 years old in Detroit.
Really?
I wanted to cover him, and my news director wouldn't pay for the overtime, so I went out there by myself, interviewed him, came back, edited it. It was all on magnetic tape at the time, and did a couple nice little stories about it. But let's jump ahead to he's with me in Columbus, Ohio, at a live event we were having on stage. And he was great. He looked good and felt good, and he died at the airport going back to Toronto.
Yes.
But I was his last interviewee. He was my first interview. I was the last person to interview him.
Really?
And he passed on. Unbelievable timing.
Yeah. Well, he was on a cruise ship with me once.
And he loved what he was doing.
He did.
Yeah. He had a passion for that. Let's go to the phones. Mike in Seattle, Washington. Mike, welcome to the program.
Yes. My question for Seth is, do you believe that there's a 3-mile-long mothership on the side of the moon that faces away from us?
Well, it's very convenient, Mike, that it's on the side of the moon where we can't see it directly. So that makes me suspicious.
Why are they
hanging out in a place where you can't see them?
Maybe they don't want us to know where they're here, huh?
Yeah, maybe. But, you know, that's not a very safe place because there's going to be a lot more spacecraft that are going to go around to the back side of the moon, if you will, that will be able to see anything on that side of the moon fairly soon. In fact, they just launched, well, no, they haven't launched it yet, the JWST, the James Webb Space Telescope. And
goes up on the 22nd. So
yes,
far.
That's right.
Keep our fingers crossed.
And if it makes it, I think that it is going to be parked in a position that's on the other side of the moon, too, although, of course, it won't be aimed at the moon.
No, not at all. Mike, thanks for that. But did you ever hear the story that there was some kind of foreign, and we don't mean from our planet, foreign satellite circling the planet?
Well, that...
Did you ever hear that story? Would they call it the Black Star satellite or something like that?
No, I haven't heard that, I must say. I mean, there are plenty of people who think that there have been satellites, you know, from aliens that are circling around, but not that particular one. I hadn't heard that.
First time caller, Jim in Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Jim. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, George. Hi, Seth. Hey, I got about three different points I want to make, and maybe you can comment on. I know we're time constrained, but
sure.
My question is on optics. I mean, we've got the Hubble, the Webb, you know, CAC. We've got these telescopes. We should be able to see a mustache on a Martian fly. And I don't understand why we can't. So maybe you could explain that to me. And then, my other observation is, well, as to whether aliens have visited the Earth, I unless you believe that we can go faster than the speed of light, then I would say no. If you believe it, that you can go faster than the speed of light, it makes sense. And then the other thing is, on the DART project, trying to bump the asteroid, I'm more worried about something bumping the moon. It doesn't have an atmosphere. I don't think it would take something as big as it would hit the Earth, and I think if it bumps the moon, we're in a lot of trouble. Could you comment on those three?
Yeah, well, that's a lot of stuff, Jim. Let me just take the last one, then you can ask the others again if we have the time for that. Yeah, well, things bump the moon all the time, but they're small. They're rocks. They're, you know, micrometeorites, and then they're meteorites, and they're all flying around, and they hit the Earth too. But, you know, the moon, it's small compared to other planets. But it's not that small. You know, it has a tremendous mass, and you can bump it with anything that, you know, man-made, and it would not really notice. So that's not so much an issue. The other thing was you were talking about the faster than light travel.
Yeah, propulsion.
Yeah, and you know, whether that's possible or not, I would say it doesn't look like it is, because it would invalidate some very, very fundamental things about physics. But one should perhaps never say never. But let's assume that it isn't possible. But there is this, and this is just, you know, special relativity. This is old physics. This was published in 1903, I think. So if you are in a rocket that's going really fast, not faster than light, but maybe half the speed of light, or let's say three-quarters the speed of light, then you don't age very quickly, right? From your point of view, you're on that rocket, and you see the gray hairs and all that. I mean, you age from your own point of view just as you would normally. But the amount of time that it takes you to get anywhere seems shorter, okay? Or maybe look at it this way. The distance to where you're going seems shorter. But in any case, if you go fast enough, you could come from any place in the galaxy, any place in the universe, and get here before you die. But you have to go very, very, very fast.
And let's go back for your first question, Jimmy. Go ahead.
Yeah, on the telescopes.
Yeah, you mean, could we see the Martians' mustaches?
Yeah, I mean, how come we can see deep into the universe, millions and millions of light years away, but we can't turn it on Mars, and we can't see the mysterious pyramid up close and with just a telescope on? I don't get it.
Oh, yeah. Well, look, two things. First, any telescope on the Earth, you know, it's in Hawaii or in Chile or wherever it is, some optical telescope, it's limited in terms of the detail it can see, not by really the optics, but by the fact that the atmosphere is very turbulent. So, you know, the atmosphere is sort of messing up your view. But we have telescopes in space, most famously the Hubble, right? And that can see very fine detail. So you could say, well, why don't you turn that on Mars? Look, why turn it on Mars? We've got cameras on the ground on Mars. Right? We've got all these rovers running around. And they don't see any Martians. As far as the pyramid on Mars, there are very high resolution photos of Mars. You can find them online, and you can go, you know, to the Cydonia, I think it is, the Cydonia region of Mars, where this pyramid or the face of Mars are located.
Yep.
And what you'll see are rocks.
Let's go to Bill in Los Angeles. Hello, Bill. Go ahead.
Hi, George and Seth.
Hi there.
Hey, two issues. First, I think the Eastwood line you wanted is, you got to ask yourself a question. Do I feel lucky today? Well, do you, punk?
Now, maybe you're really...
We had pieces of that, but we were right.
And second, Seth, I'm a highly skeptical person, and I'm a Columbia J School grad, 86, and I don't believe most of the things I hear on Coast to Coast, but I got to tell you, and I talked with you about this a few months ago. Those 1952 flyovers of D.C. by supersonic craft were documented by every newspaper in the country on analog film, dozens of Air Force pilots, radar operators, General Sanford, and even President Truman acknowledged it on TV news. How can that not be a visitation, since we know the Soviets and the Chinese had no supersonic technology that could outrun our jets?
Well, we have.
Great question.
I mean, I don't know that the Soviets didn't have. I don't know when they developed jets. I mean, jets were, jet aircraft were developed during the war. And supersonic flights were from the 1950s, at least for this country, so it could have been that. But I think maybe what you're referring to is the
1952 flyover.
Yeah, the 1952 sightings, indeed, that they... I've read some explanations of them. They're not very good, but they say that this was, somewhat mysterious, but not terribly mysterious. There was some radar observation of these things.
There was a great photograph in the newspaper, Seth, that showed these little white dots all over the Capitol.
I used to develop my own film, and I got white dots on a lot of pictures, so that doesn't impress me. But if you had some detail, if you can read, Klingon script on the outside of this craft, then I'd be convinced. But, there was radar. But I have to say that radar, has its own problems because problems with atmospheric effects or water vapor. Radar sometimes produces reflections. Right? You get radar echoes in some cases where it isn't the case that there's actually something there. So that alone wouldn't do it. But I am aware of the 1952 events. And I think that the bottom line was nobody really knows what happened.
Great event indeed. And Bill, even though you don't believe everything you hear on the program, you still love the show, right?
Right.
There you go. Thanks, Bill. Let's go to Walter in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Walt.
George, remember, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. George, undeniably, We evolve in the womb. The ova and the spermatozoa are the human bugs from which we evolve in the womb, George. It's without the prodigious fossil record, George, we have that. That's your ironclad proof that evolution is the most proven tenet in all of science. George, I just want to say that I look forward to listening to Dr. Shostak. He's a terrific guest. He's an eminent man of science. And, George, if it was up to me, I'd have him on every week instead of once a month or once every 6 weeks. So, George, he's a great guest.
He's a good man, Walt. There's a great compliment there for you, Seth.
It is. I really appreciate that, Walt. People might think you're related to me after that. But
Walter Shostak is his last name.
No, I thought, I used to live in Pennsylvania, too, so I'm immediately sympathetic.
Next up, let's go to Brian in Crestline, California. Brian, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, good evening, George. This is Brian, your unexplained cameraman up here in snowy.
Oh, yes. Is it snowing up that way?
It is tonight. Yeah, there's already a few fender benders out there, and it's cold. Sorry to hear that you guys aren't coming to Big Bear
No event this year. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I missed you guys. I missed you guys the last time. But, hey, it's always great when you have Seth on. So my question for Seth tonight is, the other day, it just kind of struck me. The other day, NASA was launching their laser communication relay demonstration satellite. Personally, I've been involved in optics and the transmission of data via optics for many, many years. And now in no way am I even attempting to marginalize your diligent work in the centimeter wavelengths and possibly millimeter wavelengths, sir. But it just dawned on me, could we be missing something? Could this galaxy be teeming with much higher bandwidth electromagnetic wavelength transmission, and we're looking at something very old, an analogy would be comparing an 1865 telegraph to a modern high def television picture transmitted in the UHF band. Are you guys, or are you involved with searching the skies for single line wavelengths, possibly data, information carrying wavelengths in the nanometer or sub nanometer wavelengths, and could we be missing out on something just simply not because we're looking in the wrong place, but maybe we're looking at the wrong wavelengths or energies?
Yeah, well, Brian, that's really a good question. You know, I've talked a lot here tonight about radio SETI surveys. But also, at the beginning of the show, we talked a little bit about optical SETI surveys. So, you know, that's at higher frequency, if you like. And it's like a fiber optic. You can get more bits per second than a fiber optic band or fiber optic cable, if you want to call that, than you could down a coaxial cable carrying a radio signal. And then everybody knows that. The aliens know that, too. And that's why we also, in addition to looking for radio, we also look for flashing laser beams, right? Or maybe not even flashing. So there are experiments to do that. Say one more thing about radio, though, because people do say, look, or at least they tell me, they say, look, Seth, you guys are looking for radio. That's so old school. The aliens will have moved on to something else. Well, maybe, but that doesn't make too much sense to me, because if you look at what we do, we have communications over every frequency range, right, from microwaves all the way up to optical fiber optics and so forth. You use whatever you can because you're always going to want to send information around.
Seth, how long are you going to do this? You're going to keep going as long as you can?
Well, yes. When I can no longer get myself into the office, maybe I'll stop in. But I enjoy my job.
Good for you. Good for you. And your book, still available to folks?
The books are still available, and there may be actually a new book in the offing, actually.
So. Ooh.
Yeah, I haven't written it yet, but there's talk from a publisher, so maybe.
Do we have a projected name?
No. I may leave that to you, George.
I'll name it. I'll name the title for you, and of course it's going to be on alien hunting, right?
Yes, in fact. Yes, that's part of it. Yep.
We'll definitely do that, and Look forward to a great holiday, my friend. You ready for Christmas and everything else?
No, it's hard for me to believe that it's like a little over a week away.
It's fast.
Yeah, and then it's suddenly over.
It's fast. Has COVID struck that area badly?
Not up here. I'm in the Silicon Valley, and, you know, the people here, almost all of them are vaccinated and boosted and all that. So there's not too much COVID right here. That's not true of California in general, but not so much here.
Yeah, Kelly, I'm told, has a new mask mandate now for everybody.
Yeah, that's right. If you go inside, you got to wear a mask.
All right, my friend. Take care, Seth. Talk to you next time.
Okay, thanks, George.
Up next, we're going to talk to an animal communicator about animals, what they do, and what they think. And if you are a pet lover, of course we all should be, this is going to be a fascinating, fascinating discussion.